Our speaker tonight will be Kerry Oman. He has 4 degrees, is one of them a doctorate? He has 4 degrees in history and has taught classes at BYU and SMU and University of Utah. He had an experience with, I don't know if you've heard about the Widowmaker heart attack, had the Widowmaker heart attack and survived. After that, he recovered. He got cancer and had another experience.
Thank you. Yeah, I've survived several things, and hopefully I'll survive this, too. I've never shared this experience to anybody outside of just some very close people, so I was a little hesitant to say yes, just because these experiences are very intimate and special to me. Let me just tell you about who I am. I'm a Utah native, grew up in Sandy, and then moved to the Mapleton area, if you know Mapleton, just south of Provo. That's largely where I grew up, went to high school at Springville High School, and loved sports and outdoors and all of those fun things. When for me, after I got done with high school, I wanted to go back and play football and had some opportunities, decided to go on a mission for the LDS Church and went to London and came back and then played football at BYU in 93 and 94 and stopped, got married and to my lovely wife, who's here and really is probably the reason I've survived all these things. My love growing up was always, you know, I loved the history of the American West. I loved American Indian history. And so as I started going to school, I went to BYU. I started taking history classes and realized, you know what, that's what I want to do. I want to research and write. I love to write. And so I decided to make that a career and get a PhD. So I received a bachelor's and master's degree from BYU and then went down to Dallas, Texas, and went to Southern Methodist University and received another master's degree and earned a PhD while I was down there. And then we wanted to come back to Utah to raise our children, and I came back and had an opportunity to teach at the University of Utah. Taught up there for a couple of years. The appointment, the only position they had when I came back was a visiting assistant professorship, which was a 2-year appointment. Just had a great experience, taught Western American history and environmental history and American history and a few things like that. And at the end of the 2 years, they didn't have a tenure track opening at the University of Utah, and there weren't other options in Utah, and we wanted to stay here. And we had a few opportunities to go out of state to teach, but decided to stay here in Utah, and so I switched. My dad's a land developer, and it was 2005, and if you remember 2005, real estate was going like this, and I thought, you know, like teacher salary wasn't really very exciting at the time, and so I switched and went through a hard transition. So that was probably the first survival I did, but got into real estate, and I've been doing real estate since 2005. As I think about my experience leading up to it, back in 1996, so a long time ago, 22 years ago, I started to get headaches, started to get these, what we determined were just a chronic daily headache. They got pretty bad, and they have been ever since then, whatever day in 1996 they started. Some of them would be bad and some of them would be worse. It's one of those things that we've tried everything. So we've been to neurologists, we've been acupuncture, acupressure. Everybody has an idea. Everybody says, oh, you ought to try this for your headache. And so I would go and try this. And I say we because Diane was always with me. And everything you can imagine, I've tried to get rid of these headaches and never have. So in 2000, I guess it was around 2010, I decided, you know, why don't I try a real hardcore diet? And, you know, maybe that'll help. So I got on what they called the paleo diet or the caveman diet, if you've ever heard of that. So it's the idea where you go and you eat fruits and vegetables and lean protein. And, yeah, I've always been an athlete. I've always enjoyed to exercise. And I thought, you know, this will be great. I'll get healthy again and just back into really good shape. I'll exercise and be on this diet, and who knows, hopefully this will help my headaches. I tried lots of caffeine, little caffeine, and neither of those helped. So I got on this diet in about, I don't know, 2009, 2010, and got into incredible shape. I was going to the gym in the mornings, usually from about 6 to 7:30 or 5:30 to 7:30, and an hour and a half, sometimes 2 hours, sometimes not quite as much. And many times in the evening, I'd go back. A couple of times, my oldest daughter's here, and she She's an athlete, and there were times we would go back to the gym together at night, and I just got into crazy, crazy good shape. My routine was I would get to the gym, and I would usually run 3 to 5 miles on the treadmill, and then I would go lift weights, and while I was lifting weights, I would do a set, and then I would go do push-ups. And I was getting to the point where I would do about 700 to 1,000 push-ups every morning. Not in a row. I would do 100 push-ups, and then I would do something, and then I'd do 100 push-ups, and I'd do something, and sometimes I'd stand on my hands and do push-ups, and just these ridiculous things. I would watch things on the internet to get other ideas, try to emulate all these crazy things, and I was in phenomenal shape. And October 13th, 2013, so I had been doing this for probably 4 years. I had been diagnosed with high cholesterol. When I stopped teaching at the University of Utah, I had to get private insurance because real estate agents, nobody wants to insure real estate agents. So I got private insurance. I thought, you know, I had to get life insurance. I called and I got a life insurance guy to come over, and it was a State Farm guy, and he came over and did a cholesterol test and came back and said, hey, we denied you. And I said, why did you deny me life insurance? And he said, well, your cholesterol's too high. He said, you're a time bomb. It was like 360 or, it was pretty high, and I had never gotten a check. Part of the idea when I got on this diet was to control my cholesterol as well. So it was kind of this multifaceted purpose, and it must have been August of 2013. I'd been in and done my checkup, and without medication, just with diet and exercise, my cholesterol was really, really low. Just perfect where you wanted it to be. So I was feeling pretty confident, but October 15th, I went down to the gym, ran several miles on the treadmill. I was just, you know, finished my routine. That day I did a chest routine, and so I was lifting weights and felt great. I was just finishing my last set of 100 push-ups. My throat started to burn, and I thought, you know, that's really weird. It was like, you know, if you ever do sprints and you get that burning sensation, you know, when you run really fast, it was that. And I hadn't been running. I'd been doing other stuff. And I thought, that's weird. And I started having a little bit of pain right here in the middle of my chest. And I thought, dang it, I just pulled a muscle is what I thought I did. So I finished doing my push-ups, and I grabbed my keys, and it was at Anytime Fitness in Springville. We live in Springville, and we only live about 2 minutes away. So I grabbed my keys and thought, I'm going to head home. I always tried to plan it so I could see my kids before they went to school. So I'm driving home, and I'm thinking, why is this burning, and that's really weird. And the pain in my chest was starting to get worse. I pulled up to the house, got out of the car, and I was feeling a little bit lightheaded and just still thinking that was really strange. And I went in the house, and the kids were in. Diane was cooking them breakfast. And so I sat down in the family room because I didn't want to alarm anyone. And I just wanted to kind of see how it was. And it was getting really bad. The pain was at this point. That burning was still lingering there. And so I called Diane and I said, hey, will you come here? I said, I think I just hurt myself at the gym. Will you call my doctor? My doctor's a friend of mine, so I had his cell phone number, and gave Diane my cell phone and just said, here, just call him and tell him I hurt my chest and see what he says. What should we do? Diane calls Stuart's his name, and Stuart picked up and said, if he's having chest pain, you probably ought to go get it checked out. Take him to the hospital. Probably nothing. And Diane's standing right here, and I'm sitting on the sofa, and all of a sudden, the pain, it was just like I got hit with a sledgehammer. Hopefully no one's been hit by a sledgehammer, and I haven't, so I don't know what that feels like for real, but what I imagine getting hit by a sledgehammer would feel like, and right in the middle of my chest, and just bam, bam, and I just kind of fell on the ground. I was rolling on the ground, just grabbing my chest. Still didn't think I was having a heart attack, but Diane turned around, and she said, hey, we've got to go to the hospital. So somehow I struggled to my feet, and we made it out to the car. We started heading out, you know, thinking we would just drive to the hospital. At the time, still, I just didn't know what was going on. But my arms started to get numb. I had the tingling going down my arms. We made it 2 blocks. So if you can imagine, 2 blocks from my house. I remember looking around, and then my eyesight was gone. It was just pitch black. And that scared me. For some reason, going blind's always been a fear of mine. And so I was really scared. I just all of a sudden knew I was dying. Here I am, the pain, I couldn't really move my arms at this point, and the pain in my chest was just excruciating. I couldn't see, and I turned to where I thought Diane was, and I just said, hey, I'm going. I want you to know that I love you, and tell the kids that I love them, and I said, I'm going to die. At that point, I just blacked out. Diane saved my life. I had two choices. One, she could floor it and try to get to the hospital, which was about 15 minutes away, or she could call 911 and get some help. And she chose to call the ambulance. That one act, the EMTs later told us, he said, you know, so often people decide, I don't have time to stop. They die en route. I was still kind of in and out a little bit at that point, and we met him down the street. And I remember kind of waking up, and this guy's cutting my shirt off, and I thought, what in the heck is this guy cutting off my shirt? That's my favorite workout shirt. I was like, couldn't he just pull it off? Or I still didn't know what was going on. That was my really strong feeling. And then they started shaving my chest, and they were poking, trying to get IVs, and putting things in my mouth. They put a number of Advil in it, and a nitrile pill, and were just working on me. And the EMT who was closest, there were a couple of them. I remember some blood spurting out in the car. But the guy's like, hey, I've got to get you out of the car and into that ambulance. And I just said, I can't move. And I'm a pretty big guy. The EMT, he just reached in, picked me up, and carried me over. And I was so glad he was strong. Got me on the gurney, put me in the ambulance. And for some reason, they didn't allow Diane to come. She had to follow me. The pain was so bad, my legs started shaking. And just uncontrollably, I couldn't stop shaking. They strapped me in. I remember my legs, and the guy just kept saying, you've got to calm down. You've got to calm down. Just try to be still. And he just kept saying this. And so my mind, I said, I've got to calm down. I've got to try to let my legs stop bouncing. I remember my shoes flipping off, because they were bouncing so much. And as I think about it, I'm still not sure I totally understood the severity of it. I remember thinking, I wonder if we're taking the freeway or if we're going through town. Later, it was one of the first things I asked Diane, did we take the freeway? Do you know? It's funny what your mind does when you're in these kinds of situations. But as we were driving, I had that real distinct impression that I was starting to fade away. And finally, I got to the point, I was shaking so bad and the pain was so extreme. I knew I was done. That was it. And I told the guys, so I had a guy, you can envision, I'm laying here, and there's a guy here, and there's another guy here, and there's one driving. And I told this guy, I said, hey, I'm not going to make it. And I said, I want you to tell my wife and my kids that I love them. And the guy said, hey, tell me the name. What's the name of your oldest child? His name's Tyler. And he said, well, how old is Tyler? And I said, Tyler's, he's 18. He said, well, what's the name of your next oldest child? And I remember laying there thinking it's Alyssa, and I just couldn't speak. And all of a sudden, the pain's gone, and my legs stop, and if you can envision the picture again, I'm here, and all of a sudden, my body's there, and I'm up here looking down. And it was like those movies. The best thing I can describe it is it's like those movies where it just pushed pause. And everything stopped except me, and my first impression was pain was gone. And it was just this incredible feeling of peace. And I remember just being glad. I was like, at least, my legs have stopped shaking. It was so important for this guy that my legs stopped shaking. And then it was, the best way I can describe it is, if you ever learn something new, and you think, you know what, that's really interesting. You have that aha moment. For me, I thought, you know what, this is what it feels like to be dead. And I'm looking at my body, and the pain's gone. And I thought, wow. I wasn't scared. I wasn't panicked. I just thought, wow, that's what it feels like to be dead. And I'm looking down. I remember I could see my shoes. And here I am laying down, and all I had on was my shorts, because they cut off my favorite shirt. So I've obviously never told anybody this but family, but I knew it was me. I remember looking down thinking, one of my first impressions after that sense that this is what it feels like to be dead. I realized, you know what, you don't take a damn thing with you. And so here I am. I'm in real estate, right? And I'm not only in real estate, I sell a lot of big homes. I sold the biggest homes in Salt Lake County and the biggest homes in Utah County that have ever sold in the history of Utah. And I work with these people with lots of money and big, huge homes. And at the time that this was going on, I was working on a real hard real estate deal with this massive home. It was really tough. And so in my mind, I just think it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how big your house is. It doesn't matter how much money's in your bank account. It doesn't matter everything that you have, because you don't take it with you. I'm looking at my shoes thinking, I'm not even taking my shoes. Yeah, I wish I would have looked down to see what I was wearing, but I didn't. I knew it was me, you know, so, and that was my first impression, was you don't take anything. It doesn't matter. You know, what matters is who you are as a person. What matters to me is my family, my relationship with God, and that hopefully I'm a good person. And this all likely takes place in seconds, but this is, you know, that's the first impression I had. But I knew it was me, and I knew I was going somewhere. Intellectually, you know, everything was the same. My background is Western American history. My love is Lewis and Clark and American Indian history and the Mountain Men and the 19th century American West. That's what I specialized in. I've written several articles, and so that's my passion. And so in this short time, and I have no idea how long this lasted. It probably didn't last very long at all, but for me, I had some profound experiences. But the next impression I had was that I was going somewhere. And I had this image in my mind of Lewis and Clark. I've written some articles on Lewis and Clark. And if you know their story, and so it's funny, you're dying and you think of Lewis and Clark, but that's what I did. I thought, you know, it was their experience when they got to St. Louis. They had a map to the end of St. Louis. Well, they actually had a map up to the Mandan villages. But as soon as they got past that, they didn't know where they were going. It was this unknown territory. And that was my impression. I knew I was going somewhere, but I just didn't know where it was. And I didn't have a choice. I've talked to some people. I had a friend who had an experience, and he had a choice. And I didn't have a choice. I was going somewhere, and there weren't bright lights. There weren't people to greet me. It was pretty powerful. I remember thinking about my family, and I'm watching my body while all this is going through my mind. I guess the best way is like a stream of consciousness. These thoughts and ideas were just racing through my head. And then I remember the guy grabbed my body and flipped it over and started working on my chest. All of a sudden I was back, and the pain was back, and my legs were shaking again. Right at that time we pulled up to the hospital. They wheeled me out. I remember kind of looking around. I'd sold a house to an EMT doctor, and I remember looking to see if he was working. The next thing I know, I woke up in a room. I look over, and my wife Diane is by my bed, and my friend Ben is back there, and my mom and dad. And that's finally when I realized it was a heart attack. So the first thing, I guess, when I woke up, I asked my friend and my father. I said, hey, I need a blessing. So they gave me a blessing, and right after that, the doctor came in, and I said, hey, congratulations, you just survived the Widowmaker. He said, nobody survives these. And then he said, you know what, I want you to start eating healthy, and I want you to start exercising. No kidding, that's what he told me. I was like, I'm going to Five Guys, and we're going to go to In-N-Out, and, you know, forget all this, because the other stuff doesn't work. It works because it made you feel good, but I realized immediately that there's certain things you just don't have control of. And I said, why did this happen? You know, I'm 41 years old, in the best physical shape I have ever been. I have like 5% body fat. I mean, just crazy. And he's like, you know, I don't know. Figured it was probably a mix of genetics, working out too hard, stress from work, weak point in an artery, just a fluke deal. You guys who are specialists on hearts, I'm not, but your heart has a big artery coming down the front called your LAD artery, and it was 100% blocked at the top of my heart. No blood was getting through. He said, you know, the only reason you survived is because you were in such good physical condition. It was interesting. Diane told me, she said, you know, the EMTs who brought me in were so affected by it that they wouldn't leave the hospital till they found out what happened to me. The gentleman who's over them in Springville is a friend of ours. And he told me once I got released from the hospital, we went, we had a long conversation, and he said they had never worked on somebody who was in as good a shape as I was, and it just shook him to the core. And he said they wouldn't leave the hospital until they knew I was okay. As I got talking to him, he said the one person who was sitting here came back and just broke down to his boss. He later told me, he said, his experience has been anytime somebody has told them that they're dying, they die. And he said, when you said that to him, he just didn't think we'd ever get you back. I thought a lot about that. Why did I survive then? I don't have an answer for you on that one, but I wonder, why do some people survive and some people don't? I think things just happen in life. And I've also wondered, why didn't I see people, right? And I ask that question now, especially to a group like you, because I've had an experience where I felt the presence of somebody who passed. My older brother and my younger sister both have passed away. They both committed suicide, in fact. My older brother, just to share you a brief experience, just to tie that in, he was a year and a half older than me. May 1st, 1995, he took his own life. He was almost 25 years old. And he and I were pretty close. He got into drugs and had struggled with some things and took his life. I've struggled with that my whole life. Diane was pregnant at the time with our oldest son. So here I am, just to paint a quick story, but I was working road construction. I was going to BYU, and I was working road construction, and the foreman pulls up, and it was back in the day where you have the brick phones. You know, you remember the brick phones. And he said, hey, you've got to call home. Something's gone on. And so I call my sister, and she tells me, and anyway, it was a bad experience. Well, 2 months later, I'm back working road construction again, and the same foreman pulls up. He says, hey, you've got to call your mother-in-law. And I was like, huh, I wonder what's going on. Diane was 32 weeks pregnant at the time. He said, you've got to call. Gives me the big phone, and I call her. She said, hey, Diane's here on the hospital bed. The baby stopped moving. The baby's dying. You got to get over here. We're just waiting for you. We've got to take the baby or he's not going to live. I was covered in concrete, literally. I was the guy that shoveled, so that's why I was covered in concrete. Got in my car, and I drove to Utah Valley Regional Hospital. And so if you can imagine, my conversation doesn't turn at first to God. It turns to my brother Dane. And I don't know why. And here I am driving to the hospital as fast as I can go, and I'm pleading with Dane, saying, hey, look, man, if you put us through all this, if there's anything you can do to save my son, you got to do it. I don't know how it works up there. But I had this conversation with Dane. I had this really profound experience that he was there with me. And all the way I talked to Dane. Got to the hospital, and they looked at me and were like, wow, and covered me with gowns and said, wash your hands and don't touch anything. They took Tyler emergency C-section. He was 3.5 pounds and survived that experience. It was all because of Diane, again, that he survived. But I had this experience with Dane, and this is 1995, and over the years I've had these other experiences where I felt him close and almost had these conversation-type experiences. And I wonder, why didn't, you know, here I am dying in the ambulance. Why wasn't he there? I don't have answers to you, but I'm just tying in my story. And then in 2007, my sister, who I switched and got into real estate, and she helped me get into real estate. She was struggling with bipolar disorder and going through a hard time. She was 33 years old and took her own life, too. Yeah, I remember just being so mad. You go through these experiences. How could you do this twice to a family? I remember being mad at God and being mad at my family and being mad at my brother and sister and asking all these questions. You know, why do these things happen in life? And I don't have answers. But so I'd had those experiences leading up prior to my heart attack. I think those kinds of experiences change you, right? My biggest fear was that it was going to happen again. I talked to a couple of people who had had heart attacks, and it seems like everyone who's had one has had two. I don't know if that's true. If I apologize if anyone's in here and has only had one. You probably won't have two. But I've been told that by a few people, and so I keep thinking, when's the next one going to happen? It took me 18 months to go back to the gym, and I still haven't done any push-ups. Because when you do push-ups, man, you have a heart attack, so don't do them. But I do other things. And you know, my daughter, who's been a great athlete, and Michael, who's a great athlete, going to their games. And you go to these games, and you see these parents who are just screaming. Again, forgive me if one of you guys are one of those guys, but screaming on the sidelines. And I just, you know, you go through something like that, and you think, why are you getting so upset over a game? And I'm a pretty easygoing guy, and I was before, and I think even more so now. And those things just, you realize, just aren't important. About 6 months after starting to go back to the gym, I found a lump right in my groin. So if you've ever kicked a ball and you pulled your groin muscle, you know, and I found this lump and thought, oh, crap, that's not good. I thought maybe I pulled a muscle at the gym again because I was going back. And so I didn't do anything about it. And this was, I don't know, July of 2015. And it started to get a little bigger. I didn't tell Diane. Just hoped it would go away. And then maybe November, I found one on the other side. Realized, you know, that's not good. So I called Stuart again, my doctor. And he said, yeah, why don't you come in? It's probably a hernia or something. No big deal. And but he said, schedule a time to get in. So I call in December and scheduled to go in February because I don't know if I wanted to know. I went in February, and he ordered an ultrasound. And here in my mind, I'm thinking, there's no way this is serious, right? Because I've survived a heart attack. You know, I have a heart attack and cancer. Sorry again if you've had that. They sent me in to do an ultrasound. The ultrasound person said, well, there's one, and there's one, and there's one. And they found 8 tumors on the right side, about the same number on the left. And the ultrasound person can't tell you, right, because they're coming in to see if it's a hernia. She's like, oh, your doctor will talk to you when you get done. So I talked to my doctor. They got me in with a surgeon. They did a biopsy, and it turned out I had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. An aggressive form of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which, you know, I guess good and bad. You know, the good is it's a treatable kind. People still die, but there's worse types of cancer. So I went up to Huntsman Cancer Institute, and they did the body scan, and they found a whole bunch of tumors in my groin area, a whole bunch of tumors in my stomach, and some under an arm, you know, maybe one under an arm, but diagnosed as stage 3 cancer. If you've been through that, that's a tough diagnosis. So different from our heart attack. My heart attack, you know, I've had other friends who've said they've had heart attacks and it lasted a couple of days. I was like, we had different heart attacks. From when I felt the pain to when I was leaving my body was about 15 minutes. Cancer is a slow process. And I went up to Huntsman and had a wonderful doctor, and she said, we've got to start doing chemo, but your heart's not in great shape. Because when you have a heart attack, it damages your heart. And so when I left the hospital, the bottom of my heart wasn't working right. And my ejection fraction, for those of you who've had heart attacks and know that number, it was 40. It was lower than it should be, but not as low as some. But they were worried that the chemotherapy treatment my heart wouldn't be strong enough to handle the chemotherapy. And they finally decided it was worth the risk because of the type of cancer and how far it had spread. So they said, we're going to do a treatment of 6 infusions every 3 weeks. And I said, well, before we go, I had this trip planned to Mexico. We'd already bought this trip. We wanted to take our kids down to Mexico. And I said, I'm not going to do a treatment until I get back from this trip. And they said, no, you're not going to Mexico with cancer. You know, something could go really wrong. You've got to start immediately. And anyway, I talked them into it. So when we got back from Mexico, I started treatments. For those of you who've been through chemo or been around it, you know, it destroys pretty much everything. After my third treatment, it was June 2016, so about 2 years ago, I had just had my third treatment, and I started getting sick. Doctors were, hey, look, if you get a fever at all, you've got to come up and come in. You don't have anything to fight the fever. And I told Diane, hey, look, let's see how it goes. It was one night. It was a night, Saturday night, and I didn't want to go up. And she really wanted me to, but we decided we'd wait and see what happened in the morning. And if you've had chemotherapy, you know, they give you this, at least at Huntsman, the first time before my infusion, they pull out this 3-ring binder. And they start going through it page by page and saying, here's all of the side effects that you could get from chemo. And they said, but don't worry, you're not going to get them. But these are the things that you can. And then they have you sign a form that says, I understand, I'm probably going to get all these. And I'm not kidding. I had every single one of them. Yeah, I remember laying on the couch at night in terrible pain, sick as can be, and just thinking, why do you go through these things? You know, praying and feeling like there's no answers. You know, just for nights, I couldn't sleep. And I used to drive around, because I sell real estate, right? And if you don't go to work, you don't get paid. In my business, and if we don't get paid, our family suffers. And so I would work, and I would drive around with a bowl in my car so I could throw up in the bowl and keep driving. And, man, nights laying on the floor in the bathroom and Diane was always there. Saturday night, I started getting a fever, and next morning I woke up, and it was probably 101, 102, and Diane said, we've got to get up there. So we drove up to Huntsman, and they admitted me immediately and started giving me some medication, and they didn't know exactly what was going on. And over the next 10 days, they thought I was going to die again. I don't know if it was a day or two after I got admitted, my fever spiked up to 106. For 3 days, I had a fever around 106. If you know 106, that's not a good thing. If not, Google it and see what happens to you if your fever hits 106. My oxygen level was way down, and they were just pumping me full of all kinds of medications. Yeah, I was on 4 or 5 antibiotics, and they started giving me some hallucinogens. I forget, Diane knows all these things, and yeah, I have the most wonderful wife, and she remembers everything, and I just, if I don't have her next to me, I feel lost, and when I don't know, she'll tell me the answers. But the infection had gone sepsis, so it was all over, and I was just, they'd cranked up the oxygen, and you know, I just kept going down, so they'd turn it up higher, and I remember the doctor came in and said, you know, this one medication can kind of make you see things. And he said, have you had that experience? I said, no. And I was looking at the wall and said, are those spiders supposed to be crawling back there? And he's like, no. You know, the bugs flying around the room. And so they took me off that one. But I remember the nurse coming in when it was starting to get really bad. The nurse came in and took my temperature. And I remember she called another nurse in. And I'm not doing very good at this point. And she said, you know, if I put this number into the computer, you know what's going to happen, right? They're talking right next to me. And I don't know how high it was, but it was somewhere between 106 and 107. She put the number in, and then everybody just flooded into the room. So we had infectious disease, and we had all these doctors and nurses now for the next several days trying to figure out what in the world's going on. They couldn't stop it. It started getting so bad that they called my kids back and said, hey, look, we don't know if your dad's going to make it. You know, you better come back and see him. At the lowest point, and they'd been up there that morning, and so they drove back and came up to see their dad, who they didn't know if they'd ever see again. You know, talk about a humbling experience. You know, to talk to your kids after you go through the heart attack, and after you go through cancer, where they really think they don't know if you're going to survive. And later, talking about my kids, how they experienced that just breaks my heart. I had a number of blessings during that time. Just kept getting worse. Finally, the doctor came in and said, you know what, we don't know what's going on. And they said, we want to do a bronchoscopy, or you know, where they go in and take a tissue sample out of your lungs. And they said, but we can't really give you any medication for it, because if we do or put you under, we'll never get you back. So, you know, we're just going to put it down. It won't be bad. So they put this thing down my throat and take a tissue sample, and I was out of it anyway, so it didn't hurt too bad. And they finally were able to find out which kind of pneumonia it was, get me on the right kind of medication. And my feeling is through all the love and the prayers, a wife who never left my side. I was there for 10 days, and she was there every second. You know, I turned a corner. The next day, I was feeling better, and a few days later, I was packing my bags. I wanted to get out of the hospital, because hospitals aren't fun places to be. And then 3 months later, in September of 2016, they told me the cancer was in remission. So I survived that experience and just had my last checkup on Monday, and it's still in remission. So I don't know if it's like a heart attack if you get two, but right now I'm good, and so I'm waiting for the next thing. But I'm hoping that I've got the hard ones out of the way, so the next ones will be easy. But so in a group like this, so what's the takeaway, right? You know, how does that change your life? Why do some people begin? You know, and I think about all these things I've been through, and I think, why do some people live and some people die? Because I've had two experiences where somebody else might have passed away, and I didn't. And there's not a single thing I could have done differently to affect the outcome. And so my belief, you know, is really, I don't know, is I don't think it was my time. And I don't know exactly why that is. I believe that part of it is because of my wife, Diane. In every single hard time I've been through, she's been right there by my side. And it's, you know, I think she's almost willed me to survive, if that makes sense. You know, it's funny. After my heart attack, you know, it affects you, but I think I became almost disenfranchised with people a little bit. Just had almost given up hope on the goodness of society. And the one thing cancer did was brought that hope back, in that there were so many people who came and shared their love and support with me during that time. You know, I realized, well, you know, I think people are pretty good. The biggest thing I've realized, you know, if you take into account, I've had a brother and a sister who've committed suicide. I've survived a heart attack. I've survived cancer. I survived a trip in Guatemala where first time we nearly died. That's a whole other story, on a lake. Had an experience in Grand Canyon I'm not going to tell you about, but I've had these experiences where, yeah, I'm that close to dying, or my family has. And I'll tell you the one thing, and then we can open it up to questions, that I feel like is I went through these experiences because I needed to learn that life is worth living. At the end of the day, you take everything out of it. I had to learn that life is worth living. And you've got to love your kids, and you've got to love your friends, and you've got to give them hugs when you can, and it's okay to be a man and hug people. And you've got to tell people you love them, and you've got to be there for them, and you've got to not worry when somebody cheats you, and you've got to not worry when life doesn't happen how you think it should. And you need to be the kind of person that at the end of the day they say, you know what, that is a good man. And I don't know if I've accomplished that, but that's my goal, is to be a good man and a good husband and a good father. And I'll tell you, I'm not afraid to die. I don't want to, but I'm not afraid to. So,
you said you had two experiences. We didn't hear much about the second one.
So the second one was during that pneumonia. You know, so those are some things that, yeah, I was pretty close, and you know, I had some other personal stuff. But
you are one lucky guy. My brother, who also had high cholesterol, but it was under control because he was taking medicine for it. He went to the gym from 12 until 2, came home because he wasn't quite feeling well from 2 until 5, suffered a massive heart attack at 5:15 and died at 5:18. You are one lucky guy. When the doctor performed the autopsy, he said it was his second heart attack. Just
oh, wow.
FYI. So you are one lucky guy. Your job is not done yet. That's all I can say.
When you were describing your out-of-body experience in the ambulance, did you hear any sounds? Did you hear discussion going on among? Were there any other sensations that you had?
That's a really good question. I've never thought about the sounds. So I don't remember the sound. I remember seeing things. I remember seeing cars go by in the window. And the thoughts and the feelings and the sensation. But I don't remember sounds. I'm going to think about that. I'm sorry, I don't have an answer to that.
You said that you don't know why, but yet at the conclusion you gave 3 or 4 really good reasons why you needed to be kicked around to get your priorities straight. You know, when we ask why questions for these kinds of things, why my daughter, why my wife, if we start with the premise that there is nothing that happens to us that God doesn't allow to happen, because there's heavenly purposes in that for me, for you. If I start with that premise and then say, what purposes were intended for this, for me to have this pain and this experience, I think that you'll find that there are solid, substantive answers that are uniquely crafted for you. You know, maybe somebody else doesn't have to have mortars hit in the family foxhole and yourself nearly die at a time when you feel disenfranchised and not really connected. This isn't worth it. But no, you really do. You have a testimony that there's purpose in those things for you. And I think you should write your story.
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate you saying that.
When you were in the hospital so sick with your cancer, did you ever feel the presence of your brother at that time?
So, yeah, I did, my brother and sister. Yeah, I was in over 10 days, and there was probably 4 days where I was really bad, and one day where I was, that's when they thought I was going. And I remember feeling their presence. I remember wondering how it works, what they were doing, feeling like it was going to be okay, that you know, I was going to see them. I remember feeling just the calm when I, you know, I guess when my kids came and my parents came, and you know, that's probably when I felt their presence the strongest. Maybe more of a just a reassurance that it was going to be okay. It's interesting. I've had that other times too with my brother and sister. That really strong presence at different times, depending on what I'm doing. My brother a lot more than my sister, who he and I were. We fought as kids, but we're pretty close up until when he died.
When you said you kicked off your shoes, your legs were shaking so much. It's a good title for a book.
Write that down, Diane.
I think so.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine that you were so much different before these experiences, that you were a different kind of man before. You wouldn't have your wife so incredibly much by your side if you had been a bastard. Right?
I think you're right, yeah.
So before the experience, what kind of a man were you? What were you thinking? You said you don't take anything with you. We know that. And the only thing that matters is love, how much you loved. We know that. So what is the difference before and after for you as a man?
I think the biggest difference for me, you know, I guess there's a couple. I live in a world where people have millions and millions of dollars. Not me, by any means. But I work in that. And I mentioned I was working on this deal, but there's been some homes I think, man, that would be really cool to live in that, you know, $10 million home or whatever it is. And just thinking that, how important. It didn't consume me, but it was enough that I thought a lot about it. And since then, it is just the least important thing in my life. I love these people and work with them, but for me to want that, I think that is one of the biggest things that's changed. And I think that's probably why, honestly, that was my very first, other than, wow, this is what it feels like to be dead. Sorry again. That was my first impression, right, that is not important. That has just stuck with me really strong. Other than that, I've never been one to go scream at kids' games. I try to be a good person. Maybe I'm less religious. For me, one of my passions in life is photography. Probably my biggest passion in life is landscape photography. My wife and I go do a lot of it. We just got back from Ireland on an incredible trip. And after my heart attack, I find solace and peace in nature and go, and that's where I've had the strongest spiritual experiences since my heart attack. So those kinds of changes, I don't know. I hope I was a good person before. We can ask Diane that too.
I just wanted to say that you've stressed so much the importance of the closeness of your family. I came from a very dysfunctional family. I have never had anyone by my side, anyone that I could know was going to be there always. When I was 10 years old, I swore I am never going to bring a child into this world because they're just going to be on their own. And I never have brought a child into the world. And I'd just like to ask you, what is there besides the love of close ones that would make life worth living?
That's a good question, too, and I'm sorry for your story, too. So maybe I could answer that in a couple different ways. You know, outside of family, I have some very close friends. I grew up in a family where you didn't hug, you didn't really touch, you didn't, I mean, that wasn't something we did. And, man, I hug these guys now and tell them I love them. Never would have done that before this experience. And for me, to get that love back from friends, other than family, you know, because family, for me, has been, they've always been there for me, but I would say friends. I would also, what else makes my life worth living? I'll tell you, hands down, the number one thing that makes my life worth living is my wife. No question. You know, there's some other experience I haven't shared, but she's saved my life on a couple of other occasions. But the other thing for me is nature. I mean, you get out and you have bad days, and I think we've all, I've suffered depression since my heart attack. You know, I've gone through hard times. I mean, we could talk about that another time too, but for me, what gets me out of that, what makes me appreciate the world is when I get out with my camera and I look at how beautiful this world is. You know, I watch the news and think, wow, the world's falling apart, so I don't watch the news. But I get out and I see the beauties of nature, and you realize, wow, this is a special place. And then you go around the corner, and Diane and I will go different places to take pictures, and you think, wow, what a beautiful place. You can't find a prettier place. Then we'll go somewhere else, and you think, wow, you know, I am so glad I had the opportunity to see this. And so for me, I would tell you, it's experiencing a relationship with nature that helps make my life worth living.
You hinted about religion, but I wondered, how did your perspective on religion change? How were you different after this all happened? More intensity or less intensity?
We're LDS. Since that happened, and particularly, you know, there were hours. For me, it was like that, right? I didn't have time to think about it or pray during my heart attack or do any of that. It just was. But since then, and just time when I was so sick with chemo, I can't tell you how many hours I probably laid on a sofa, just so sick, either wanting to die or thinking I'm going to die, and just praying and thinking, why don't I get an answer? Why have you forgotten about me and my family? You know, thinking about a brother and sister, you know, I thought so many hours about them, and why does that happen? And then why do you have a heart attack? And then, you know, I'm really not a woe is me, but it sounds like it. Maybe I am. I would say I've probably questioned more. Are you there? And then I'd have an experience where I feel like, yeah, definitely God's there. And then something happens, and I think, you know, are you there? And why aren't we getting those blessings? And then I have another experience, and I think, there's definitely, he's there for us. And I don't think those experiences fall within the parameters of a religion. I mean, that's a spiritual relationship between me and God. And I think probably over the last 5 years, it's more of a personal relationship with God than it is an institutional experience for me, where I would say definitely before it was the institutional side was by far more important. And, you know, now I have both, but, you know, I think that has changed. I'm probably trying to seek out more of those answers on my own.
When you felt you had communications from your brother and your sister, how did you differentiate those from your own thoughts?
With my brother, I've talked to him. And I don't hear a voice back, but I have a distinct feeling that he's there and listening. And it oftentimes happens in my car where I actually talked out loud thinking, hey, Dane, you know, what should I do? What am I going to do with this? And feeling like he's there. I think the responses are probably in my head, right? I don't remember him talking outright, but it brings me comfort. It brings me peace. My sister has been, for me, more of impressions that she's there during some of these hard times, or has somehow helped play a role to get me through some of those hard times, where I think my relationship with my brother is a little closer, however that works. But it's, so how do I differentiate between my thoughts? I'm not sure, you know, other than I feel that strong sense that I'm not going crazy yet, that there is some kind of a connection there.
I've survived colon cancer 3 times.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
I live now with a pre-cancer, but in 2012, one of my major surgeries, I didn't go as far as you did, but I remember my daughter standing at my side, and she says, "Mom, if you have to go, I'll be okay." She had just buried her son. When my daughter died of 4 kinds of cancers, she never complained, but I know it was my religion, my faith and connection with God that helped me survive that. It's been pure hell, but I know she's better off, she's happy, and I'm surviving all of this. And I've become a stronger person myself because of all of that.
Well, congratulations, and bless you with your health. You know, before my heart attack too, you think, why do we go through these things? And, you know, all of it makes us stronger. And I think the other thing, I guess, the takeaway I have, and I haven't mentioned this, but it's allowed me opportunities to talk to other people. Just an individual experience where you can be there to support them, to listen, to say, you know what, I know what that feels like. You know, and I think that's different than the person who says, I can imagine what that feels like, right?
I noticed that you talked briefly about how you went through a time where you were angry, and my daughter and son-in-law just lost. Her parents were killed. They were in a foreign country, and they were killed about 5 months ago. And they've had a series of different traumatic things happen in their life, and right now they're both very mad at God. And something else happened after all of that. So maybe you could speak to that a little bit about kind of how, if that was real for you, if it was something you voiced or you just were quiet about it, or how you got through that process of being angry, or if you were, maybe you weren't.
Yeah, no, I've been angry a number of times. I don't even know if I can find it, but I wrote this down after one of the experiences about my brother. You know, so you talk about being mad. Why did these things happen? I wondered how God could let that happen. You know, talking about just my brother just died. How can that happen to anyone? But why our family? What causes someone to do that? What are the answers? From that point, I started looking at life differently. I started asking myself a lot of questions that I haven't been able to get good answers to, questions that I think there just aren't answers to. I've decided bad things happen to good people all the time, and good things happen to bad people all the time. I don't believe that bad things happen because it's punishments from the Lord. I think stuff happens. I believe in God, but I think He's just really busy with other things when it comes to me and my family. So he just lets life play out. And it goes on and talks about just one of the things that makes me mad is time heals, right? You hear the story, time heals. Time makes me mad because I forget. You know, my brother's been dead a long time, and I forget those details that made him who he is. For me, there's an anger of, why do you let this happen? Why does this happen? And then there's an anger of, man, I can't remember all these details that I want to remember. Why can't they be here? And I still struggle with that. I don't know how you get through that other than time heals, but time's also a bad thing, I think, you know, for those memories, because you start to lose them.
So
So a phrase keeps going through my head that's really, really strong. Sometimes you have to lose to win. Just like with Jesus Christ, look what's happened. Because of his influence, and he died on the cross. And because of that, look what we have left for us to look forward to. And I see that in your life. You have so much, what's the word I'm looking for? Now that word's not coming. But you work around so many wonderful people. You have so much to offer. And so you're a wonderful example to us that you've lost a lot. You've went through a lot. But you have so much to offer us to keep us going in the right direction. And I also see, with all the hell that we all have in our lives, that sometimes the adversary goes after those that are going the right direction. And it's just a progression of getting through it and enduring and being resilient, getting through it and showing us. And you have a lot to offer me. And I really love and appreciate that you shared your story with me tonight. And I thank you so much.
Oh, that's really sweet. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Based upon your experience, do you believe that we have to experience the negative in order to appreciate the positive?
I do, for sure. I think, you know, like one of the gentlemen pointed out, you know, I've said a couple, you know, different things that I don't understand, but I think, you know, my takeaway really, as I thought about it all, is I think it's taken all of those bad experiences to just tell me, hey, life is worth living. You know, and I think nature has done that for me too. You know, all of these bad experiences have helped me appreciate the good ones. I think you're right. Yeah, definitely.